So are you concerned about all of the information that our government and certain companies know about us, from our buying habits to our internet searches and the like? Well, our guest this hour says that one day you will be controlling all that big data and it will benefit you. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, and we will welcome your questions for our guest this hour. He is the author of The Naked Future: What Happens in a World That Anticipates Your Every Move. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Patrick Tucker, technology editor for Defense One and deputy editor of The Futurist magazine. He writes about many different topics, including information technology, big data, and predictive analytics. His first book is The Naked Future: What Happens in a World That Anticipates Your Every Move. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thanks for being with us. Now, you are called a futurist. You describe yourself as a futurist. What exactly is a futurist?
That is a very good question. What sounds very exotic, doesn't it? Would you like to become one?
Yes.
Okay. Do you have a prefrontal cortex?
Yes.
Do you have $23 for my book?
Maybe. I have your book, though.
You do have my book, so you're already there. Mm-hmm. So I'm really a journalist that covers the future. A lot of people call themselves futurists. The organization that I've been a part of for a long time that publishes the Futurist magazine, the World Future Society, has this definition. It's basically anyone who thinks about the future most of the time. And what we know is that that's actually all of us. Mm-hmm. We evolved the prefrontal cortex to do exactly what we do all the time, which is extrapolate from patterns, anticipations of what's going to happen next. We spend about 70% of our mental time just in the future. So short answer is congratulations. You, too, are a futurist now. The problem is that both you and I are actually terrible at it. We are no good. Our prefrontal cortex is fantastic at extrapolating patterns and coming up with predictions for stuff that's happening in the world around us, like in the wild. I mean, we evolved this capability in order to avoid being eaten in chaotic jungle settings. And we're actually pretty bad at making predictions about the future when it comes to stuff like the price of crude oil in 6 months, or the possibility of a particular nation rising or falling, or one company doing really well over another one. Now, so basically, even though we spend all of our time thinking about the future, at least a good 70% of it, according to research, we're not any better at it than we were when we evolved this capability before we were even humans. Now, here's what's changing, is that as a result of big data, as a result of 1.8 million megabytes of data that we create on a yearly basis, individually, we are gaining a window into areas of the future that previous generations never would have thought possible. And that's a remarkable change in the way humanity deals with what is really the oldest and most important idea we've ever had, which is the future. Because, of course, it is just an idea. It's something that we make up continually over and over again. It's not a place where we're going to reach. It's something that gives our lives meaning. It gives organization to our actions. But it's a invention. It's a continual invention, and we're about to change the way we continually invent it in some pretty fundamental ways in just the coming 5 to 10 years.
Well, give us what do you mean by the naked future? What's going to be naked about it?
So, well, we walk around with this sense that there's a lot of stuff that we can't know about what's going to happen, and specifically what we're going to do. But through the data that we create, we're beginning to get a sense of different areas of our lives where much greater prediction is possible. So let me give you a more concrete example. Do you know where you are going to be about 50 weeks into the future with higher than 80% accuracy?
Boy, maybe if you gave me a little bit of time, I would have some general thoughts, but probably not.
Right. Yeah. Of course not. Well, what about 80 weeks into the future, even further out? No, right?
No.
No, absolutely not. Me either. You can make a pretty good inference if you have two data points, which is where somebody lives and where somebody works. But that's just an inference based on two data points. We feel like we're much more random than that, and we actually are. So at the same time, the data to understand that riddle, to figure out that future, is actually data that we give away to our phone all of the time. We just create it by accessing GPS. And we don't access GPS in a way that allows us to telegraph that movement, but we still create it. It's still usable. And a couple of researchers figured out how to use it. So I spoke to a guy named Adam Sedelik. He was at the University of Rochester at the time. And he partnered with a guy named John Crum, who was at Microsoft. And they wanted to see if they could predict mobility patterns using GPS information. So what they did was this. They hired a bunch of people, just test subjects, to carry around a GPS receiver very similar to the one in your phone. And John Crum watched them for on the order of 3,200 days. So really it's something like 6 years. It was a data set of 6 years of human mobility on these subjects, just where they went. That's all it was. Not why they were going there, not what else they were doing, no other sort of external marginal information, just where they went. And he found that with that data set, with 3,000 days of data, he could, with Adam Sedelik's formula, anticipate where they were going to be within like a two-block radius and with like a five-minute time window, 80 weeks into the future, with higher than 80% certainty. Now, that's really remarkable, and that's the naked future right there. Your activities telegraph where you're going to be in a way that we thought was impossible. We assume ourselves to be far more random than we in fact are. Well, and based on guessing, we'll only get you to about 50%. So there's this pattern that emerged when he had enough data that sort of showed people's future at location in advance.
So he would be able to predict that I'd be at the corner of Hollywood and Vine based on my GPS searches.
Yes. Yeah, pretty much. And also, if you've got even if you wanted to keep your GP, if you didn't want to talk about your location or where you are right now or keep all of that stuff secret, if you have a couple of friends that sort of geotag their tweets and they tweet about you, he still has a good 50% chance of figuring out where you're going to be as far into the future as like a month.
So why is this, though?
Amazing and powerful and good and not creepy.
Yeah, I was going to say, that kind of creeps me out. Why would I like that?
Yeah, it's creepy and gross and sad and scary and it's, oh my God, a world I don't want to be a part of. If you're thinking about it in terms of this is stuff that other people will use to ambush me or trick me or trap me. So if it's only the NSA, if it's only Target, if it's only someone else that has this capability on you, then we're living in a dystopian world that we all hate. Now, if you have that capability, you have a superpower, right? If you have the capability to know where you're going to be that far into the future, then you're not going to use it to ambush anybody. Most people wouldn't. You're going to use it for something else. You'll probably use it to avoid people you don't want to see, right?
Maybe.
Doesn't that sort of make more sense? And that's how I want to get people to start thinking about this, because this is information that you created. You gave it away to your phone and your AT&T, your Verizon, whichever carrier you're using, has access to a lot of this mobility data. They render it anonymous. They sell it to marketers. And that is a temporary state. We feel like we are at the mercy of machines that speak about us in a language we can't hear, to people we can't see. But the solution to that is to create actually more data and to understand it. And once we do that, then Adam Sedelik and John Crum, the thing that they did is just representative of an ability that we'll all have. And that's what I'd like people to sort of understand, is that there's no guarantee that this sort of capability democratizes. But the potential is certainly there if we decide to seize it.
Yeah. How are we going to seize it personally rather than just having it, in the hands of the NSA or Google?
Mm. Well, there's a lot of different services that are sort of springing up that you can begin to use. And I think that as we decide that we want more and more, of this information to use, then the ecosystem for those types of apps is really only going to grow. But what's also important to understand is that the cost in terms of time, convenience, complexity of using this stuff is going down the same way the time, cost, and complexity of using all technology is going down, because this is fundamentally technology. So it's going to follow the same trajectory as all other information technology that came before it from the beginning, from the middle of the 20th century, where we used to talk about computers as things that filled gymnasiums. They were not tremendously powerful, and only academics and military personnel got to access them. And now every one of us that's listening, 70% of the American population, according to Pew, carries around a smartphone that is several factor times more powerful than the computers we were working with in the 1960s. And this is the story also of our big data. First, we created, and we're not able to access it because that access is limited to some very small groups, and then it's democratized to a slightly wider circle, and then it goes to everyone. And so, like I said, first we're going to start accessing it via services that really speak to a fundamental need and desire that exists in the consumer population, which is to use this stuff for ourselves rather than just give it away. So here's a concrete example, all right, because I don't want to just frame it as though it's something that's going to happen, hopefully, and not something that actually is happening now. There's a great company called TickTrack, and what they do is they let an individual take all of the different data streams that they create that they can track, like your Fitbit data, like your Nike Plus data, which shows your past location. You can combine that with stuff like your Amazon ratings or your emailing or if you've got a wallet app that shows your spending, stuff like that. There are new monitors now that can help you monitor your mood and take a log of that. So what TickTrack does is it allows you to see all those data streams and how they're interacting. So all of a sudden you have this window into yourself that nobody else has. You know, for instance, how where you go influences your mood, or how your interactions with a particular individual influence, like, your drinking, or your susceptibility to coercive marketing, or even, you know, your potential of falling victim to a crime or something in the next few hours. That last one really speaks to a future capability, but it is one that exists within the realm of possibility. And TickTrack is the beginning of bunches of different services that are going to spring up that are going to help us to access more and more of this data that we just create passively through all of our digital interactions.
So there might be an app for that if I want to avoid that drunk friend of mine.
Yes, there will totally be an app for avoiding drunk friends. That's going to happen. There's going to be an app for also. That's the way you have to think about interfacing with this information. We already carry around this machine that's watching everything that we communicate to. And by everything, I don't just mean people, of course. I mean every time we access a door, every time we go to the subway, every time we access our bank account, we carry around a device capable of logging all of that. It knows where we are going. And then this is just a matter of combining all that data and with a bunch of other people's big data to come up with a list of probabilities, looking at our behavior over a large enough data set. And one day you're going to walk around, and instead of getting a push notification on your phone saying, hey, this is the Whole Foods that's two blocks up. We noticed that you hadn't eaten much today, and we're running a special on sushi. Would you like to stop in? You'll get that notification, but also a notification from a service that you subscribe to saying, hey, just so you know, you often regret that type of purchase, so you have a 60% chance of regretting this purchase that you're about to make, because the thing that's on special is shrimp tempura, and you thought it was healthy, but really after you eat it, you kind of know that it's mostly shrimp in batter, and you feel bad about it afterwards, and it's not in line with, you know, your calorie goals for the day. So we recommend you skip, because you have a 60% chance of regretting that purchase. That's like the opposite of advertising, right? Yeah. There's not even a name for that, but that's the sort of capability that's possible when you look at what your data says about you in the context of other data.
We are talking about the possibilities, talking about that big data isn't really evil. It's going to be helping us in the future. What do you think about this? What would you want your app to tell you based on your habits and data? If you could predict the future and use that to better your health or avoid being the victim of a crime or learn better according to your individual learning style. 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Our guest is the author of The Naked Future, What Happens in a World That Anticipates Your Every Move. Does this sound good to you or not? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking with Patrick Tucker. He is the author of The Naked Future, What Happens in a World That Anticipates Your Every Move. He's telling us about how all the data that already is being gathered about us can help us in the future. We'll have access to all of this, and we'll like it. We wonder if you think that you will like it. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Well, Jerry on Facebook says, big business and the NSA already have their hands on our cookie jars. Does anyone really think we can just slap them on the back or slap their hands and they will better respect our privacy? The lazy lemmings that we seem to have evolved into probably means Big Brother is here to stay. So Jerry is just concerned about his privacy, it seems, and you're telling him don't worry about it, Patrick?
No, I'm telling him you keep worrying about that, Jerry. You just worry about it a little bit smarter. Here's the thing. So we're going through a big fundamental discussion of about our privacy right now. There are a bunch of groups that actually look out for us pretty good, and I think they deserve our support and attention. The Electronic Frontier Foundation, the ACLU, these folks are providing a really valuable service right now. I'm a member. At the same time, being frustrated isn't a strategy. So it's just not going to work. We need to have a conversation about what our metadata is, how it's used, where it goes. For instance, I mean, right now for my new job, I'm covering a lot of NSA stuff. The NSA has a new pick as head. His name is Admiral Michael Rogers. He had a confirmation hearing before the Senate Armed Services Committee. It wasn't even for his job as head of the NSA. It was for his job as the head of CENTCOM, which runs NSA. And because apparently, to be head of NSA, you don't even need a Senate confirmation hearing. It was a pretty sparsely attended hearing. And the Senate Armed Services Committee asked him a couple of very brief questions about whether or not he thought the administration's movements to curtail NSA abuses were adequate. And he answered, oh, yes, absolutely so. Absolutely so. These are he basically said the problem right now with the NSA is a PR problem and that we are capable of respecting, privacy and rights. And we're going to start communicating to the public better, and I'm going to take the rest of my comments in a classified setting. So I'm not for a second suggesting that we don't want to listen in on these hearings. We don't want to ask questions. We don't want to be vigilant. I'm saying this. Here's the facts. We're going to be producing on the order of 44 times as much digital information in the year 2020 as we were in 2009. So just being upset and saying, well, I give up. I don't like them anymore. You know, they have access to everything, and it's just frustrating and boo. It's just not going to work as a way out of this. We have to sort of wake up, understand the opportunities that are in front of us to actually use some of this stuff for ourselves, and figure out where it's going and why. And here's the thing, too. So we right now have this feeling like the NSA has this enormous treasure trove of information about us. And you know what? They do. Just this week, it was a new NSA capability was revealed. It's a program called Mystic. They can actually replay phone conversations that go back 30 days. So they claim that they're not using this on American citizens. They never make the claim that they're not using it on foreign citizens because that's within their, you know, legal purview to do. And that's very, very odd and strange. But that information got out from Edward Snowden. It's just the reason we're talking about it, the reason I can talk about it and the Washington Post can report on it is because it's only the latest in a long line of leaks from Edward Snowden. This is actually exactly what I'm saying. No matter who you are, no matter how big your institution or your organization, once you start collecting this data, it's not like plutonium. You just increase the chances of more people having it, of it becoming democratized. Edward Snowden, you know, it doesn't matter if you think he's a hero or a villain or if it's more complex than that, if he's a hero who perhaps deserves to be prosecuted for breaking U.S. law or a villain who perhaps deserves amnesty because he was working with, you know, First Amendment motivations. None of that matters. What we know about him is that he's the world's most famous systems administrator. He was a guy that worked for a contractor and had a difficult job, but not a spectacularly unique job. And he was able to do to the NSA what we feel like the NSA is doing to us, because that's the way this data works. Once you have it, you have to use it. In order to use it, you increase the chances of more people having it. And the same is true of Target. Target, which we feel like understands us and all of our data on this extremely intimate level, is also constantly subject to hacks and data thievery. And so we just have to understand that the information that we make, it, yes, is going to pass to very large entities, but from there it's only a matter of time before it passes out to the public. And I envision that cycle just accelerating and becoming faster.
Yeah. So will I don't mean to focus on my drunk friends so much, but will I have my drunk friend's data? And then I'm going to be checking out his every move.
Well, without getting too speculative about it, do you have your drunk friend who tweets? Does he or she ever drunk tweet and perhaps geotag their tweets? Because in that case, you sort of already do.
Oh, yeah, that's true. So that's part of it, though, is if I'm going to avoid that person, that's going to be a part of my app.
Yes, exactly. So more of that type of behavior that's released to the public voluntarily in the context of lots of other data and your data creates better models, better Bayesian algorithms that are going to give you a improved possibility of avoiding that person when you want to avoid them. But the information that you need to stay out of their way, a lot of it you've already got because of this transition that we've gone through where we're creating public information through our every move. And so this is why I really continue to stress, be vigilant about who has your data, but also take ownership of the fact that you created too. So that means that you have much more control over it than perhaps you think.
So what else do you think we should be excited about when it comes to our ability to predict the future or the how big data is going to help us in the future?
Well, I've talked to so many really inspiring people in this book that gave me so many great ideas. And I think some of the most inspiring material that I came across is when I talked to people that were associated with a movement called Quantified Self. And it sounds a bit narcissistic or like navel-gazing. In fact, it's the opposite of narcissism. Because I think of narcissism as having walking around with a deluded, probably inflated sense of one's self-worth. So what this movement is about, what the people that are partake in this Quantified Self movement, what they're about, not partake, engage in. Can't really partake of a movement. But what they're really about is using data collection technology to understand their life in a way that's much more real than most people understand. So a great example of this is a guy named Ray Kurzweil. Maybe some folks are familiar with him. He's a friend. He, you know, said some nice things about the book. And he, in many ways, is sort of a pioneer for this movement. Back in the 1980s, he started creating spreadsheets that showed not only what he was eating, but just like the chemical breakdown of all the different foods that was going into his body in terms of like sodium and protein and things like this, his exercise levels, all of this, he kept these extremely detailed records. And we would have thought it was kind of neurotic. I mean, this is weird, bizarre, sort of obsessive compulsive behavior. But he teamed up with a doctor named Terry Gross to see how they could use this information to make him feel more healthy. And he started taking like lots and lots of different supplements and just sort of experimenting with them and, you know, seeing how they changed the way he felt. And here's the thing. It sounds a little bit weird. I mean, he has this reputation. He's this famous inventor. He now works for Google. He's won a National Technology Medal. But he has this reputation as being this sort of strange person who has this obsessive-compulsive behavior where he was logging everything that he did and took 200 pills a day. But what he accomplished from that is that he's basically self-treated his diabetes and coronary a congenital heart issue outside of conventional medicine. And you talk to him now, and he's like, I feel great. This is fantastic. I can look forward now to a much brighter future than my father, who prematurely died of heart failure, had because I undertook this. Now, what's fantastic is that all of that record keeping that was really difficult, a little bit less so for him than it would have been for the regular population in 1980 and 1990, is becoming so much easier for everyone. And so we're going to have this fantastic sense of ourselves and what we can do, how we feel, and how we're going to interact with the environment and what result that's going to have. And we're not just going to use it to feel better. We're also going to use it, like I said, to avoid people we might want to avoid, and that includes avoiding people who might get us sick. We're going to use it to understand the way that we learn on a much deeper level. You know, I mean, we've walked around with this notion that learning is something that happens when you sit down with a book, you spend enough time on it, you focus on it enough, and eventually you go and you apply the knowledge that you accumulated reading the book to a piece of paper. You're judged on that on the basis of how well you can accumulate information, and then on the basis of that you get a degree, and then on the basis of that you get a six-figure job. This is absolute nonsense and doesn't speak to the way we actually deal with information. We're going to have a much clearer sense, both on the teacher level and on the student level, on the individual level, of what it takes to get information into our heads, what information we need in our heads at any given moment, and how to use that information. We're going to have a much better sense of that going forward. And I'm really excited about that, I think, particularly.
Well, this all sounds great, but I'm just trying to figure out about how we can, I don't know, we can learn better right now just going on the internet to kind of get some information, or we can be healthier by, you know, finding out information about how to control our heart disease. What's different about the future than it is right now?
Well, right now the big difference is that really taking a very detailed sort of data look at ourselves is a little bit costly. And that's why we still have all of these sort of old institutions that don't serve us very well, that we consider to be the places that we go to for this data. Like, you want data on how people learn, you go to education boards and they'll tell you. And what's different is that, imagine a future where you're going to know, you get a push notification on your phone that tells you, if you quit what you're doing now and start absorbing this material for this test in 2 weeks, you're going to have a 60% chance, a better chance of retaining it than you would otherwise. And if you wake up tomorrow at 7 instead of 6, then you review, then you're going to have, here's your future grade on that test. And that's a short leap from there to getting rid of tests as metrics, because that's a silly thing. And that's very different from what we do now, where we kind of work off of advice we were given a long time ago in terms of how to accumulate information and how to show it off. Instead, we're going to have a real and empirical understanding of how our brain works with this sort of information. And it's going to, that understanding will flow in the form of these constant sort of real-time interactions with cloud-based services that tell us, hey, we have a strategy for you to meet your goal on the basis of everything that we know about you. And here's what that means right now at this moment. So we've never had that before. We've never had this weird little moving window into our future as it's changing. And that's going to alter our decision-making, hopefully for the better, on the individual level and at scale, meaning all over the world.
Our phone will tell us to do our homework.
Your phone will tell you, well, it's not just do your homework. Your phone's going to tell you, don't eat that.
Yeah.
It's going to hurt your test taking. Don't talk to that person until later. Because we walk around and we won't necessarily, we'll know the outcome of different decision making much better, much clearer, not the total outcome, but we'll have a much clearer sense of how our different decisions interact with our goals. That's a fantastic capability. That really is a superpower, and it's one that's waiting for us.
We are talking about the superpower that we one day will have, according to our guest, Patrick Tucker. He is the author of The Naked Future, What Happens in a World That Anticipates Your Every Move. We're talking about big data and all the data that's being collected on us by institutions, and right now pretty much controlled by those institutions. He says that this data one day we will be in control of it, and we will have access to it much more so than we do now, and it's going to be good for us. And we're welcoming your thoughts and questions about this. What is the future going to look like because of all of this information that's being gathered about us, and how can it help us? 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Are you looking forward to this naked future? Or what questions do you have? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking with Patrick Tucker. He is the technology editor for Defense One and deputy editor of The Futurist magazine. He is also the author of The Naked Future, What Happens in a World That Anticipates Your Every Move. And we are welcoming your thoughts, your concerns, your hopes, your fears about what all this big data might mean for us in the future. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Let's take some calls. Milagros in Pleasant Prairie is with us. Good morning.
Good morning. Hi. This is really fascinating, and I appreciate the forward thinking of the guests, but I'm just wondering, when it comes to technology and our reliance on it, like things like cell phones, I don't know anybody's phone numbers anymore because I rely solely on my cell phone for that. And I understand that you can have backups, but I happen to have a old school flip phone. So when I lose my contacts, I feel a little bit lost. And when you're going into the future and you're relying on your best decision-making based on technology, what happens when that's taken away?
Well, so you rely on an old-school flip phone, and that's awesome to keep it beta, by the way. Shout out to old-school. But that's a technological improvement over old rotary phones. I mean, it used to be that you only had to know a handful of numbers because there was only a handful of people to call. And now we have like this huge abundance of people to call. So it's not a question of, to me. I think you hit on something that's really key. You said you feel a little bit lost. We're not actually lost. Time hasn't moved forward. We're not actually in any tremendous danger. We just don't feel like we're keeping up with everybody else. When we walk around and we don't have immediate access to a number that we might need because we've lost our phone, it's, you know, a psychological burden. It's not a real burden. We can go and find that number after a period of time or call some number that belongs to someone that we can recall and then get the number that way. It's a psychological issue when we don't feel like we're connected to the technology that everyone else is connected to. And we'll continue to have that. That's not a fault of technology, though. I think that, broadly speaking, we need to be enthusiastic about the fact that we keep making things that make our lives better. that's probably a good thing. But yeah. It's also human nature to feel like that's not that it's not happiness. You know, more information doesn't necessarily create more happiness, and neither does technology. It doesn't vanquish happiness, but it doesn't necessarily create it. You know, I mean, look at the there's this great Louis C.K. bit about airplanes. I don't know if anyone has heard this, but he points out he was on a plane not too long ago, and it was one of the first planes that had Wi-Fi, and the person that he was sitting next to was like, "Ah, the Wi-Fi on this plane is terrible," and became frustrated. And Louis C.K. was just sort of laughing at the ridiculousness of this, that this is our species. I mean, I have this too. I have this strange impatience with technology, no matter how fast it's going. How strange to be seated in the air with access to all of the world information, and because the connection to that access is like a little bit slow right now, we become impatient and frustrated, and that's not the fault of technology. That's actually just the fault of the way our brains work, and it totally makes sense. But
yeah, what about
we're going to keep having that? Though we're going to continue to feel like, oh, this isn't fast enough for what I want it to do right now, and oh, where's that thing that I need? I can't believe I'm so reliant on technology and cut off from it from this moment. That stays with us no matter what.
Speaking of how our brain works, though, I think Milagros was also, she felt lost, but do we risk the technology doing all of our thinking for us? It's going to tell us, how to do this, that, and the other thing. It's going to remind us about this, that, and the other thing. And are we going to forget how to think because our phone is doing it for us?
Don't buy it. I think that we're going to think in a new way. I think that what's going to happen is we're going to have access to much more information that's going to change our decision-making processes. And the potential exists to take shortcuts, sure, which is probably an okay thing. Some people won't use that information perfectly, but the information by itself will be benign. It's just a tool. We're going to use it the same way we've used all the tools of the past. I don't yet know of a tool we've created that has succeeded in wrenching our humanity from us. But there's certainly been tools that we've created that we've abused horribly. And yet, I'm still glad that we have pretty much all of them, even though the evolution of progress, goodness knows it's not smooth. And goodness knows there aren't huge gaps of inequality, of problems, of danger in implementation. By and large, no technology has yet succeeded in wrenching humanity away from us, and I don't think this one's going to either.
Let's go next to Brian in Burlington. Hi, Brian.
Hello.
Yes, what do you think?
Yeah, I actually had questions concerning the implications of this kind of technology for individuals with intellectual disabilities. I work with young adults with intellectual disabilities, and there's a lot of adaptive technology that exists that provides a huge benefit to life. But I've always thought that there's been something lacking, and what he's describing is more sort of holistic and intuitive. And I've wondered if he's thought about what the implications would be for sort of the different kind of prompting and support that it provide, leading to more independent living, employment for individuals with intellectual disabilities.
This is a fantastic question. Yes, thank you so much. I didn't look specifically at individuals with intellectual disability, but I talked to a lot of different people who looked at all of the different things that we do with education. And yes, this potential certainly exists. A lot of the way we relate to people with intellectual disabilities is informed by, again, a lack of patience. And that lack of patience is a result of the fact that we just don't know what to do with what's before us. We're using these very crude tools to measure interaction. And so when the tools that we have to measure a quote-unquote normal student's interaction with test material don't work with a different type of student, we're like, okay, we can slap this label on them we can put them in like the frustrated box, and we can train an entire special group of teachers just to deal with people that the rest of us find frustrating. And that's a crap way of dealing with people. These are unique individuals, and they all have really unique strengths and weaknesses. And yet the stigma exists for the convenience of very large institutions. And so what's great about the data of the future, the data that we're creating right now, is that we're going to get over that, because we're going to be able to, with these folks that have intellectual disabilities, that perhaps just have trouble learning English as a second language. Anybody in any setting where they feel like they're just not intellectually at the same level as everyone around them, but they actually are, we're going to understand what about their interactions is working for them and working against them and help everybody get to speed much better. Let me give you another example. So I spent a lot of time talking to Andrew Ng. He's the creator of one of these MOOCs, these massively online courses. And they've been given a sort of a bad rap lately because I think they've been misimplemented. But the potential there exists to understand how all of the different students are interacting with material on an individual basis and create a data set that's, like, really huge. And it also presents the opportunity for people that don't normally raise their hand to ask a question, to ask a question. And that's really key because what we found, actually, is that people of color and women are less likely in classroom settings to ask questions, depending on the makeup of the class. And also, if people feel like the group that they're a part of isn't supposed to be as smart as the other group in the class, they internalize this, and it actually affects performance. It's something called stereotype threat. So if you've been told over and over again that you're, like, the smartest representative of your entire racial, gender, or sex group in a class, and that your group is not supposed to be doing as well, you internalize that, and that affects your performance. And what we have the potential to do is show everybody that's not true, that all sorts of people are capable of operating at all sorts of different levels depending on decisions that they make here and now and, like, the moment. And it's going to be tremendously revelatory. And I think that it's going to give us a much greater sense into the real capabilities that individuals can bring to bear on these educational goals. So I think you're going to see a lot more interactive data creation with people with who have been labeled learning disabled, people who are also operating at extremely high levels and just want to do a little bit better, and really all of us. And that's a tremendous change in education that's definitely going to be for the better.
Thanks, Brian, for the call. Next, we go to Richard in Rhinelander. Hi, Richard.
Oh, good morning.
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 I have a question. How is that going to affect law enforcement? In other words, am I going to get a lot more tickets in the mail because I'm going 60 miles an hour instead of 55?
Short answer is there's definitely the potential to give you a lot more tickets for going 60 miles per hour, going 55.
Yeah.
That is, the potential is there to pre-ticket you for wanting to go 60 miles per hour instead of 55. Now, the question becomes, is that a sound or workable policy from the perspective of someone that might use that information? And I would argue probably not. And truth will out in the end. But I think there's an entire area called predictive policing, which has actually been around for a little bit of a long time. I mean, it really got its start in the in New York a couple of decades ago under Bratton, who's now commissioner again. And it really just refers to the use of statistics to pre-deploy police to certain areas. And it can go great, and it can go totally screwy. And we're still figuring out the best way to implement it. But like I said, the technology itself is benign.
And we can we can also, in terms of law enforcement, just because we're running a little bit short of time, we can also use this technology to avoid being the victim of a crime?
Yes. Yes, you can. You can get, based on crime patterns that are occurring around you, it's possible in the future to get a notification on your phone telling you that based on who you are, based on what you want to go do, and based on where you are, the probability of being mugged has risen to a level that you might find acceptable or unacceptable. And then you can make a decision based on that information about whether to go out or whether to call your city council person tomorrow, maybe start participating in a few more neighborhood meetings, and your entire decision-making changes. But yes, there's a way to model your likelihood of becoming a victim to a crime, and all that's been lacking is the data. And that last piece of the puzzle falls in place in the next 10 years.
Yeah, I suppose the criminal can also know when I'm going to be outside of my home and then go and rob me.
Well, so this idea of, like, using other people's data to, like, ambush them and figure out, that also would happen in a transparent and a more transparent environment where, you know, like I said, your potential of falling victim to that crime, you're going to have more information than someone who would do that to you. But and so would anyone that would want to protect you from that, because you create that information. There hasn't been a ton of incidents of criminals using stuff like social networking data to very specifically ambush people. It's mostly urban legend. At the same time, we'll all be living in a more transparent environment, and ultimately, I think that that's going to make us safer. But it's kind of a participatory panopticon. There will be costs for that safety, and we have to start having a big dialogue right now about what those costs are and how to mitigate them. Because otherwise, I think more of us than less of us will find them unacceptable.
Andrew on Facebook says, if we as the public are providing the data points for a business to profit off of, what are the chances that we will get compensated to provide the data or opt out of the data being collected?
So opting out is going to be just a harder and harder strategy all the time. Right now, opting in is kind of meaningless. I don't know the last time I've ever read an opt-in, you know, terms of service agreement that I've opted into, because they're very long. I need the service right away. I'm impatient because I'm human, and I'm, you know, besieged by more and more of them all of the time. Opting out is not something we're going to do, because it presents new inconvenience costs that will be increasingly unacceptable. At the same time, this idea of being compensated for the data that you provide, it's a hypothesis that a great writer named Jerome Lanier has worked with a little bit in a book called Who Owns the Future, which I recommend after my own. But it's a novel hypothesis. I think it's certainly worth discussing. There's some potential for it, I think that what you're going to see instead is you're going to partner with different institutions, and instead of being compensated necessarily monetarily, you might be compensated with, like I said, sort of like more information about yourself that you can use to understand how you're interacting with the world around you. But you can also, I think you're also going to see services in the years ahead that just want to sell you the service of using your data for self-understanding, that just want to sell you the hardware to do that, that are very explicit about not sharing your data outside of where you don't want it shared. But the biggest payoff, really, I mean, and I think you're going to see people use some of those things.
Let me jump in, Patrick, because we have just a minute to go. Why should we, or should we, embrace the naked future?
Okay, well, three reasons. First of all, you're going to make more data. It's going to happen. We like interacting with information technology. We are doing it more and more all of the time. It's part of the reason that 90% of all of the data that has ever existed was created in just the last 3 years. It's because we like it. We're going to be producing much more. So that's unavoidable. Throw up your hands. Surrender to that fact so you can fight the better fight. Number two, because you make it, it's yours. It doesn't feel like it's yours right now, but you created it through your actions. And at some point, you can either demand or you'll be able to find services that can give that data back to you in a way that that's useful. And number three, more information is good. Understanding the world around us in a new way is good. It's okay that some people got to this level of transparency first. It's okay that we feel upset about that. Both of those things can exist in a world where all of us move towards a brighter future, because we create information in everything that we do. It's a wonderful transformation.
Thank you very much, Patrick Tucker. This is the Ideas Network.